Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today I'm speaking with Rob Laidlaw, animal advocate, author, and founder of the Canadian-based wildlife protection charity, ZooCheck. Rob, as usual, such a treat for me to speak with you today on the topic of dogs and common abuses of dogs, actually, that people might not be aware of. I didn't know that you were once upon a time a Humane Society inspector.
Yes, I believe if my memory is correct, which it may not be, but I think it was around the 1989-1990 period where I had an offer to come to the Toronto Humane Society to serve as an inspector. So I did that, and I was part of a team of five inspectors. And just towards the end of that tenure at the Humane Society, I was the chief inspector. During that period, I had an opportunity to do a lot of work with dogs, looking at dogs. And as well, subsequent to that time, I did work on a dog project in northern Quebec, working with nine Cree nations on humane dog control and humane education. And I've had some involvement with dogs in other areas like in Asia and Peru. And, you know, it hasn't been sort of the thrust of most of my work over the years, but certainly it's been an interest of mine because I'm a dog lover and have had numerous dogs in my own life throughout the years.
I think it's really interesting when I was reading the introduction of your book, you mention how even when people love dogs, so people that have had dogs all their lives, dog owners, even when people love dogs, they may not be meeting their needs. They may not understand that what a dog needs is more than just food, water, shelter, and maybe being petted a little bit every once in a while.
Yeah, and that's exactly the premise of this latest book. My first book, which came out about, I think it was 7 or 8 years ago, and it was a children's book as well, was called No Shelter Here, Making the World a Kinder Place for Dogs. And in that book, I dealt primarily with the bigger issues. So, you know, the tens of millions of street dogs around the world and their plight, the dog meat trade in China, and a lot of these very big issues. And what I wanted to do with this latest book, which is tentatively titled The Dog Patrol, Our Canine Companions and the Kids Who Protect Them, what I wanted to deal with in this book were some of the smaller issues, because throughout the years, I've found many people that are very genuinely caring people. They're compassionate people. They love animals. They love their dogs. They're often a little bit blind as to what effect their behavior and their treatment of their dog is having on their dog. And I think you see that with other animals too, where you get very well-meaning people that are inadvertently, unknowingly causing problems for their animals. And I think we see it with dogs probably a little bit more than with some other animals. And some of the kinds of problems I talk about are, you know, the choice of collars, the choice of leashes, the fact that probably the majority, and that, you know, I have no sort of scientific statistics to base it on. It's just my opinion based on the anecdotal information I've seen. But it would seem to me that the majority of dogs, certainly in urban areas, spend a great deal of their time alone, which many people don't realize is a very unnatural kind of situation for a dog. So there's all kinds of things that I think people are doing that may, either in a small way or in a big way, affect the well-being and welfare of their dogs.
What's really interesting about what you're saying is something that we all do, but we don't consciously think of, and that's we all make every decision when it comes to our pets, cats, dogs, whatever animal we have. We are in control of every element of their lives, from what they eat to when they go to the bathroom, as you point out, when they sleep. All facets of their lives, as you say in your book, are controlled by us.
Yes, and that's actually a concept that is sort of self-evident, but even to me, it didn't occur to me sort of, or didn't gel in my mind the way I expressed it in the book. And what got me thinking was there's an upcoming book about dogs by Mark Beckhoff, who's a writer and quite a famous ethologist. He studies the emotions of animals. And in his upcoming book and some of the promotional material, he talked about how dogs really were captives. And when I started thinking about that, I thought, wow, I think he's onto something. I think that's a very legitimate perspective. And it's one that we should all think about who own dogs. Because yes, indeed, just like the animals in the zoo or the farm, to a greater or lesser extent, because there is a continuum of you know, this occurring. But, you know, we do make all their decisions for them. Dogs generally, or at least companion dogs that are in the urban areas particularly, don't have a lot of choice in their lives. You know, their lives may be regimented. They go out at a certain time, they eat at a certain time. You know, their owners or custodians or guardians or whatever you want to call them make most, if not all, of the decisions for them. So, you know, that's something that we should all be conscious of, because one of the ideas, and you see this certainly manifested in the zoo literature, is that every animal, in order to have quality of life, one of the ways it does that is by having an ability to make their own choices. And some of those are very small choices, some of those are large choices. But choice making is the way that an animal makes a meaningful contribution to the quality of its own life. So we should realize that that is also the case for dogs. It's not just farm animals and zoo animals, it's dogs and cats and other creatures that we share our lives with.
You're actually making me think of something that Dr. Randy Malamud brought up, which was just, you know, the premise of zoos, there's the inherent like fatal flaw that captivity itself is wrong. You're making me think about that, a parallel here in terms of domestication. Because when you say, when you describe dogs as originally being captive, I mean, how do we even get past? So is it sort of a similar thing here where any domesticated pet we have, we, as well as if we're looking at a captive animal in a zoo situation, we need to start from the premise of this is something we've done. You know, we have, you know, captured or kept captive these species. And now we need to do everything we can to maximize their well-being now that they're under our care. Or is it different because thousands of years have passed? And so these animals, do you truly believe that they enjoy being our companions? Do you have a problem with having domesticated pets generally?
I think what you're saying is true and not true at the same time. Certainly, there's a long history between humans and dogs. And originally, it was thought that dogs had been domesticated somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40,000 years ago. But there's a lot of talk now. In fact, I just read an article the other day, and this article was based on recent DNA studies that suggest that dogs may have been domesticated as long ago as 130,000 years. No matter which science or informed opinion you believe, it's certainly been a long time. And that domestication may have occurred not at the behest of humans particularly. It may have been something that just happened, that a symbiotic relationship emerged between dogs and humans, and then between wolves and humans, because all modern dogs today evolve from the gray wolf. But maybe back all those years ago, it was something there where there was a beneficial reciprocal relationship, and that led to the domestication of wolves into prehistoric dogs. And of course, you know, there's a lot of thought too that domestication may have occurred simultaneously in different parts of the world, and it may have occurred at different times with dogs emerging and then dying out. But I think it's a little bit different. When domestication occurs, what you see happening is certainly the wolves, and I think it would be the case with prehistoric dogs as well, that they would evolve the longer they lived with people. And there was a study done in 1959 by a Russian scientist named Dmitry Belyaev, and what he wanted to do was to look at how quickly could he domesticate foxes. And he took a founder population of foxes, and he bred the foxes that were friendliest to people. And with each successive generation, he would only breed the foxes that were friendliest to people. And it was only in a matter of a few generations that he started to see changes. So he started to see floppy ears. He started to see foxes wagging their tails. Over about 10 or 15 generations, he saw profound changes. He saw, you know, color differences, some other types of body differences, differences in behavior. And these animals very quickly became domesticated. So, you know, the dogs have changed and now have many attributes that make them more amenable to living with humans. So I would say that while we have to be conscious of their history and where they came from wolves, and they still share a lot of attributes, both physically, physiologically, and behaviorally with wolves. You know, we have to understand that, but, you know, we should also know that we can have productive, humane, reciprocal relationships with them, but it's not easy. You know, I don't think that there is any animal whether exotic or domestic, that is easy to take care of. And dogs are a big investment, and we have to be conscious of their needs and where they came from.
Sorry, getting off topic for a second, but can you just list the other animals that you feel are acceptable to have as domesticated companions? So other than cats and dogs, are there any other species that you feel fall under that category?
Well, one that comes to mind, and again, you know, in my view, I think most horses are not treated very well, but I think that type of relationship could be established with horses. I think it's possible probably with some of the smaller animals. They're, you know, commonly called pocket pets, like guinea pigs and other creatures that have been kept by people for a very long time. I think the list of these kinds of animals is very short. What I want to stress with all of them is that there really is no easy to keep animal. Every single animal requires an investment of time, energy, resources, and knowledge to keep it properly. It's easy to keep an animal badly. It's hard to keep any animal appropriately and humanely where their welfare and well-being is at a very high level. And I think that even applies to ourselves, to, you know, parents with kids and, you know, other human situations too.
And ironically, it's the animals that appear to be the easiest to take care of that are their welfare is the most jeopardized, really. So if you go to a pet store and you think, well, I can get something that is just going to live in this little aquarium or this little, you know, square box.
Yes. And also anybody can go out and acquire these animals. You don't need any expertise or training. You don't need generally.
No license.
Yeah. No license. You don't need to pass a test. So anybody can go out and acquire a dog and they may love dogs and, you know, they have a job. Maybe they don't have a partner or, you know, a husband or a wife or a boyfriend or girlfriend and they live alone. And they, with all good intentions, go and acquire a dog. And it can be any dog. It could be a Chihuahua. It could be a low-energy Basset Hound or it could be a high-energy Border Collie or Husky. But they go and acquire the dog. And, of course, they go to work. That dog will be alone all day. They may go out in the evening because they don't want to stay home every evening. They may go out on the weekends and they may do their best with that particular animal, but often their best just isn't good enough.
So getting into these common abuses of dogs or ways in which we are not properly caring for our dogs, what is a list? Can you just like lay out what the biggest problems are here?
Well, I think one that we talked about earlier is lack of choice and control. You know, that's certainly high on the list for any animal, you know, that has, you know, more advanced cognitive capacities. And, you know, dogs have that. They're very smart animals. They're highly social animals. They're highly active animals. And they need an ability to contribute to the quality of their own life. So we need to give them an opportunity to make choices. And part of that is in the way we husband these animals. So I would say that a lot of dogs are understimulated and under-exercised. You know, one of the best ways of helping to give a dog a quality of life is to make sure that it's out as much as possible. Dog parks, I think, are a great development because it allows dogs to go out in a somewhat controlled circumstance, socialize.
Be free.
Be free. They can choose within the context of the dog park which dogs they're going to go up to and meet. They have a lot, you know, dogs are very sensory. So, you know, they have a lot of smells and sounds and there's a great deal of stimulation. So I think one of the key facets is to exercise your dogs in a variety of different ways as much as possible. And one thing that I found in researching this latest book that astounded me were these studies that said that many dogs in the studies that were done were never walked ever. And significant portions of them were only walked by their owners or custodians or guardians once a week. You know, that is not enough for a dog. And it doesn't matter whether it's a small, low-energy dog or a big, high-energy dog. You know, the dogs need to be stimulated. They need to be allowed to socialize and, you
just
know, get
go outside and smell, sniff around. And
exactly.
Different, you know, temperatures, sounds, naturally.
And one of the other things, too, is that, you know, you often see people that look at taking their dog out like it's a big chore. So they just want to get it over with, particularly in the winter. And I think people have to get beyond that. And again, talk about Mark Beckoff, he had this term, and I don't know if he developed it, but he just says, relax the leash when your dog is out. You know, don't pull your dog along. Don't see it as a chore. And recognize that when you're going for a walk, sure, you may get some benefit out of it, exercise, or if you meet other people, you get that social component to that activity. But the walk isn't for you. It's for your dog. So let your dog, as a sensory being, sniff things. Let your dog explore in the grass. Relax the leash. Slow down. And your dog will have a qualitatively a much better experience. So
it's really interesting because I have a dog. I have a pully. She's 10 years old. And especially as she's aged, she's more uptight on the leash. But as soon as we live around many off-leash parks. So as soon as we get down to the off-leash park, she becomes an entirely different creature once I let her off the leash. Her entire personality changes.
Yeah, and that's something else I talk about in the book, that it doesn't matter whether you've got a young dog or a senior dog or a special needs dog. You know, they all need that exercise, that stimulation, and, you know, that enhancement in their quality of life. And I also just want to say that, you know, I'm not trying to demonize dog owners. The majority of dog owners are pretty good people and they're very compassionate. But I think all of us, myself included, I think we always need to look at what we're doing, look at the animal, look at where it came from, and try to do better. Always find, you know, our place on that continuum of care and compassion. And try to improve. So I don't want to demonize anybody. I just want to bring to people's attention that, hey, in a lot of circumstances, we can do better. And sometimes I think, you know, as hard as this might be for people, sometimes people have to recognize that maybe they shouldn't have a dog. You know, if you can't give a dog a decent quality of life, maybe you should make a decision to try to find that dog a new home. So I think there's a lot of self-reflection and critical analysis that people should be doing. You know, like I said, I think most people are pretty well-meaning and pretty compassionate about the animals they have.
What should we be feeding our dogs? You know how some fancier pet stores now, they have raw diets, there's all different options now. What should we be feeding our dogs? Are we generally feeding our dogs well when we go to a high-end pet store and give the dog, you know, or should we be cooking at home for our dogs? Is there an answer to that question?
Well, there may be an answer, but if there is, I wasn't able to find it. You know, I read materials in researching this book about how great raw food diets are, and then I would read articles about how terrible they are. I would read, you know, articles, including peer-reviewed papers about, you know, commercially prepared dog foods of all kinds that said they were, you know, nutritively acceptable and good for dogs. What I suggest in the book is that no matter what diet you're feeding your dog, that, you know, if there's any problems or you have any questions, to make sure you're consulting with your local veterinarian. The one thing I would like to dispel is this idea by some people that dogs can't be vegetarian. Clearly they can. They have got genes that allow them to process starches and other kinds of food nutrients that wolves don't. So, you know, many dogs around the world, many of the dogs I've seen in Indonesia and China and India, and I'm talking hundreds, if not thousands of dogs, are all vegetarian dogs. So if people want their dogs to be vegetarian, it shouldn't be a problem. But like I said, regardless of what diet you're feeding your dog, if you have any qualms about, you know, about nutritional aspects of the diet or whether or not it's going to affect the dog in the long run, then it's good to consult with a veterinarian or an animal nutritionist.
It seems, though, that it would follow, just as you're talking about dogs needing choice and to be able to exercise some control that way when it comes to exercise and being outdoors, it seems that that should apply to diet as well. No, I mean, it just seems that eating the same kind of cereal every day would kind of curtail the enjoyment of an animal's life.
I think so. And certainly, again, you know, I mentioned the zoo world a little while ago. You know, food enrichment in the zoo world is something that, if not done in practice, is certainly done or talked about a lot in the literature, how, you know, providing different kinds of foods in different kinds of ways will enhance the quality of the animal's life. I think personally that just, you know, an animal feeding or being fed, you know, the same commercially prepared diet all the time would be pretty darn boring, because in the wild, they don't do that. And all you need to do is look at, you know, look at wolves, the kinds of not only prey that they eat, but other items. But if you look at dogs all over the world, and particularly street dogs, you find that they eat a very wide variety of food items.
What is your feeling on dog training?
What you want to do is use positive reinforcement where you reward the behaviors that you want to see in the dog. And I think that's the way to go. I don't think you should ever hit a dog, you know, except possibly if you're being attacked in a self-defense situation or you're, you know, that type of emergency situation. You know, it might be warranted to hit a dog, but outside of that, for training purposes or...
But I think it's the more subtle corrections, like tugging on collars, you know, chain collars and that sort of thing that people also have to be aware of, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, because negative reinforcement does involve some of these props that people may not realize are actually part of negative reinforcement. So choke collars, prong collars, and shock collars that are often used for training. You know, I see them on the streets of Toronto, especially with the larger dogs and with pit bull type dogs. You see these prong collars that when the leash is pulled, the collar is tightened. And in the case of the choke collar, it does, as the name suggests, it chokes around the animal's neck. In the case of prong collars, you know, spikes dig into the animal's neck. This to me seems like a torture device and it's negative reinforcement. You know, those types of training tools or props, I don't think should be used.
Are there any provinces that have legislation against using those kinds of props?
I'm not aware of any provinces, but certainly there are some jurisdictions that don't allow prong collars and shock collars. And sometimes they qualify the rule saying that you can use them only very sparingly in a restricted way in this circumstance, but you just can't use them generally. So there's sort of a mishmash out there. But what I saw in looking at this while preparing this book was that more and more we're seeing people trying to get local ordinances or laws prohibiting these kinds of tools. In the city of Toronto, we actually had a ban, I believe, on the prong collars, the spike collars, and that was overturned after a number of people who train dogs said, no, they're perfectly acceptable, you know, if they're used properly. I don't buy that. You know, I'd like to see them gone, but, you know, that might take some time, but it is starting to happen.
So if this is an issue that's important to you, it's important to tell your elected officials, pressure them to make changes.
Absolutely. That is well within the sphere of responsibilities for politicians and governments at the municipal level, and in many cases at a higher regional, provincial, or state level as well.
So what is your feeling on crating?
Crating, actually, it was very interesting because when I started writing this book, I was talking to a younger person that had a young family, and she didn't crate her dog, but she asked me about crating because she said she had all kinds of friends that crated their dogs when they went to work. And I was absolutely horrified. I've had lots of dogs and I would never, ever consider crating them. I think crating can be a useful tool on a limited basis for house training a puppy. It can, you know, crates can be used for traveling, of course, because it, you know, may make the travel a lot safer. Or the crating may be used for veterinary purposes. Beyond that, I think it's a horrible thing to do to a dog. Dogs are generally diurnal animals, so they're active during the day. They're highly social. You know, if they're left on their own, you know, they're very active and move around a lot. And I think it's entirely contrary to good welfare to put your dog in a crate and leave it because it's inconvenient. You know, if you go to work and you crate your dog, I would say if you're doing that all the time, you should probably think about changing the circumstance for your dog and maybe not having a dog. And I know a lot of people would say, oh, I don't want to hear that, or, you know, that's not an appropriate thing to say. But I really think it is. I think crating a dog longer than possibly 2 to 4 hours occasionally, you know, is abuse.
I would say by the same token, I've known quite a few people that section off a part of their kitchen or maybe the whole kitchen for their pets when they're not home. And
yes,
it seems that the solution really needs to be training your pet, not, you know, caging it, whether that cage is the size of a little crate or the size of a kitchen.
Yeah, certainly, you know, allocating a room in the house is much better. or even an entire floor. If you have a house with, you know, a basement and a main floor and an upstairs, then, you know, if you can allocate a floor, that's even better still. People can do other things though. If their, you know, dog is going to be alone, they can try to arrange for a neighbor to come in, spend time, a dog sitter, a dog walker. Some people, I know I was fortunate in that I could take my dogs to work. So I did that every day. You know, if you can do that, then you should. Another thing that people can do is prior to leaving, take their dog out and make sure their dog is dead tired, that it's had lots of exercise, lots of stimulation, and that will help them cope with being alone. But, you know, ultimately everybody should aim to spend as much time or make sure somebody is spending as much time as possible with their dogs as they can. One other option that some people employ is to allow their dog access to an enclosed area outside when they're not home. Now, you know, in many areas, you've got people that kidnap dogs and, you know, then sell them to labs and into other situation. So, you know, you want to be conscious of that, but certainly.
And you don't want to do that in the dead of winter with no access to the indoors.
Exactly. Exactly. But there are some people that do allow the indoor outdoor access, and that's a great help as well. So, you know, I think there's a number of options that are potentially available to some people, but I would say that if you find none of these options are workable and your dog is in a cage all the time, then you really should just bite the bullet, make that hard decision, and try to get that dog into a better situation.
So the argument that your dog is better off with you, even in a less than ideal situation and is alone more often than you'd like because they're attached to you, that actually falls to the wayside, that the right thing to do in that circumstance is meet the physical and emotional needs of the dog, have them met by somebody other than yourself.
Yeah, because it's very much like a zoo animal. If the zoo animal is stuck in a cage and can't really do anything that it's supposed to do and has no quality of life and is just existing, then I would say that in many cases,
that takes precedent over the bond between the animal and its owner.
Yeah, and what kind of a bond is it? You know, dogs are social animals. When they're outside, they, you know, want to socialize a lot, you know, and the socialization periods with people when they're coming in and out of the house, if they crate their dog all day long, they come home, they spend a little bit of time with the dog, and many of them will go out afterwards. You know, that's very arbitrary and unnatural. That's not a natural social situation for a dog.
Ideally, should a person have more than one dog then? Or if you are a very responsible dog owner and your dog gets out a lot and has lots of enrichment and time with you, is that enough?
Well, I think you know, as long as the dogs are compatible with each other, and, you know, many dogs have these fantastic relationships with each other. I had 5 dogs, and I think that really enhanced their quality of life.
Rob, so fascinating as usual. You're such a wealth of information. Thank you for teaching us all about dogs today.
Well, thank you for talking about these issues. I think they're very important.
Thanks.